is committee subs 2%, Bill 547. The committee directed Mr. Bruce to prepare a committee substitute of this bill. I'm sorry, I picked the wrong committee substitute. 45.
What?
I grabbed the one off the top. I stand corrected. It is Mr. Parr's bill, Senator Parr's bill, that was committee subs 2% of Bill 485. Mr. Bruce, could you detail to the committee those changes that were made at the direction of the committee and how you accomplished those in conjunction with legislative drafting?
Well, the first thing we did, upon the advice of the individuals who worked most in the area, notably Mr. Crum, who maybe can come up and address this one point, is we made the videotaping application more of an automatic procedure. Upon application by the prosecuting attorney and notice of the defendant, it would go forward if the victim was 16 years of age or younger at the time that the court issued the order. We also changed the offenses that were included within the bill from 1141.410 to 1141.455, and that takes in all the sexual offenses, including unlawful exploitation of a minor. Secondly, on paragraph B, we added a sentence at the end which said that the trial judge shall determine those persons other than the prosecuting attorney, defendant, and defendant's attorney who could attend the videotaping proceeding, and I believe this was in reference to a question asked by Senator Bray.
Oh.
Senator Ray, of course.
No, I didn't. It was to a question, but I don't know. I don't know. I suppose it's all right for the judge to pick the people, but
The concern here is that we avoid constitutional challenges
right.
by having
that's
by having
right.
a locked-in procedure
right.
and with the court having discretion,
right.
they're
that's
much
right. that's fine.
Much more immune to constitutional challenges.
No problem.
I thought just wanted to be clear that it was
right.
I thought
that's
it was the consensus of the committee.
Right.
Great. Continue, Mr. Bruce.
Well, basically, that's the end of the bill, other than changing the rule, which was in the previous bill.
Mr. Crum, do you have any comments on the committee substitute percent of 45? Please join us at the table, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senators, the department is in favor of the bill as it's the substitute that's here. We believe that the mandatory language is the only workable language. In the three bills that we've seen, the initial Senate Bill 485 and 547, and then there is a House bill, the number for which I forget actually, talked at one point about substantial likelihood of harm and a presumption. As we thought about it, we figured that that would subject the victims to a psychiatric examination. I think Barry Sternis talked to the committee about that. The bill in the form that it's in right now is acceptable to the department, and we think it's a good bill, and that it is very workable for our advantage.
Are there any questions for Mr. Crum from members of the committee?
Just one question.
Senator Parr.
You don't see any constitutional problem with the word shall in 9-14?
The shall in the part, no, I don't.
That's all I have,
Mr. Chairman. Senator
Ray. Line 16, the statute citations there. What exactly are those?
I looked those up today, Mr. Chairman. It's assault, sexual assault, and the last one, 455, is the, if I remember correctly, the sexual exploitation of minor. That
we have the three sexual assault offenses. The incest offense and the unlawful exploitation of a minor.
No, what's an unlawful exploitation of a minor? Taking pictures of a little kid?
Perhaps we.
A 14-year-old.
Let's address that question, Mr. Crum. Mr.
That, that is, there are six different ways of doing that, yes, Senator. One of those is taking pictures of a little child for commercial gain. Another way is to have a child touching oneself, masturbating, for example.
All right. Okay. As long as we cover those that are sexually oriented.
In line with Senator Ray's question, Mr. Crum, is there any other statute that should have been included there that we have inadvertently neglected to put in that.
Not to my knowledge, no. I think this covers it more.
I'm ready with it. You are, Senator. I would move we put it out for due pass.
On the due pass? Due pass? The move that we pass Senate Bill 45 from committee. If there's no objection, the bill is so passed from committee with a due pass recommendation. Next, I would like to take up the other bill dealing with testimony of the victims of sexual offenses. That's Committee Substitute Senate Bill 547, the Senator Bradley's bill. Mr. Bruce, could you again detail for the committee those changes that have been made at the direction of the committee in the committee substitute?
Okay, we addressed this one much like the videotaping bill in that we put it as an automatic provision on the application of the prosecuting attorney. The difference is that here the order would be granted if the court found that the child was 16 years of age or younger at the time of the trial rather than at the time of the order. We also added a section B here that the public would be excluded, but the testimony given during the time the public was excluded would be available upon request within a reasonable time to either get a tape recording of the testimony or a transcript of the testimony. We also made some adjustments in the public provision on which peoples are exempted from the word public. And this was at the, on the second page, we have paragraph 6, we have guardian ad litem or attorney for the child. And paragraph 7 is the provision which I believe the STAR representative spoke to last time, where in the discretion of the court, an adult for whom the child has developed a significant emotional attachment who can provide emotional support for the child while the child testifies. As I understand the provision here, is that especially in incest cases, it's not always the parent of the child is not always the best one to be there to offer emotional support.
What's number 5 here, Mike? I don't know. Ain't got that.
This is the parents or legal guardians of the child. I'm sorry for the copy. And also, in order to sort of bolster the bill on First Amendment arguments, we added 9, which was a member of the press, and it's my understanding that frequently press members pool assignments, and this is this is to get around the total exclusion of the press during the testimony.
Are there comments or questions directed to Mr. Bruce?
Well, there's only one. Well, that's covered right in the first one. There's only one appearance, and that's the good question.
Thank you, Senator Ray. Senator Parr?
I have a question, and I don't know enough about court proceedings to be sure it makes sense, but isn't there normally a requirement to have bailiffs or some people of that sort in the court at all times? Or going to the prisoner or that kind of thing?
Well, it was my understanding that paragraph 8, court personnel essential for taking the testimony, would be sufficient to cover that.
Well, that's exactly the reason I asked the question, Bruce, because that, to me, implies only a stenographer. Okay. It doesn't imply anybody for protection.
That's the discretion of the judge.
That's not public.
Pardon?
That's not the public. That's not the public. It's not public.
That would exempt public. Mr. Crum, could you comment on that point?
Yes.
Court officials are not in public.
Well, I know, but see, it's all persons except, right? So the judge isn't in public. See, but this wouldn't allow anyone to deal with it, if I'm understanding correctly. That was my question.
Right.
Well, Senator Parr, frankly, I don't think anybody thought about the bailiff as such. We think the court personnel essentially were taking the testimony would, by necessity, require a bailiff when you're doing a jury trial. But I'm sure that the court would not have any problem reading that into it. But you're right. That
okay, why don't we just change the court personnel, including those essential for taking the testimony? Including those essential for taking the testimony. Court personnel. Including those essential for taking the testimony. Would that do it, Mr. Clement?
I think so. Yes, sir.
You're proposing an amendment?
Yes, sir.
Could you restate the amendment for the secretary?
Established.
After the word personnel.
Add court personnel, including those, the words, including those, essential for taking testimony.
Does that satisfy you, Charlie? I think it takes care of it.
Yes, sir.
That's fine.
Yeah,
I wasn't positive about my objection anyway.
Mr. Bruce, where are you?
I'm not sure that it isn't fine either way because the court does have jurisdiction, and I've never seen the court have a problem with language like this.
Well, why do we do it though?
It's fine. The amendment has been suggested. Any opposition? The absolute has been asked for. With seeing no opposition, the amendment is adopted. It will be attached to the bill that goes to the floor. Senator Parr.
I'm sorry, but my bill. My copy is, I can't read number 5, it didn't come out. What is number 5?
Number 5 is parents, the parents or legal guardians of the child, semicolon, I think.
Okay. The parents or legal guardians of the child.
Parliamentary inquiry, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ray.
I would assume that this is an amendment that will be incorporated in the committee substitute, not amendment separate from, but amendment to the committee substitute.
A question then to Mr. Bruce in preparation. Is there a final draft of the committee substitute prepared?
No, we're just working with a draft right now.
Okay. Senator Ray is absolutely correct.
Do it that way so that we don't get any problem.
Senator Ray, you can rest assured that I would explain your amendment to the Senate, the full Senate, with all the clarity it deserves.
That's what generates my apprehension.
Senator Parr.
Mr. Chairman, what is the current state of the law on the reporting of this by this one member of the press who will be present? We're trying to strike that balance between protecting this young victim and protecting somebody who defendant's right to a public trial. I'm not quite sure what the reporter would be allowed to print the right or whatever else. I don't know what's the current state of the law on that.
Mr. Cohn, could you comment on that?
Yes, Senator, it's an open court, and he could print anything, including the names of the victim, if he wanted to.
It's an open court? We just said that we're closing the court.
Well, it is. It's open to the extent that he's there. It's open for him, and so the proceedings, as far as he's concerned, are not privileged and could be printable in their entirety, including the names of the victim.
Essentially, Senator, the constitutional concept of a public trial is being pushed to its most conservative degree in these cases. To go beyond that would probably be unconstitutional. The star chamber.
Pool reporter, such as Eugene. A pool reporter.
Yes.
And as a practical matter, the media has been.
I just wanted to make sure I understood.
Yeah, the media has been they're getting much better, actually.
Yeah.
But
we are up against an absolute constitutional bar here that would make the bill unconstitutional if we insert an absolute public bar. Senator Parr.
I keep asking questions, maybe obvious to everybody else, but let me ask it. On page 1, line 13, now we say here, during the testimony, in the absence of anything to the contrary, this means a live testimony as opposed to the videotape.
Are you asking me, Senator?
I'm asking anybody who can answer.
The answer is yes. This is the exclusion of the public is only during the live testimony. If the victim is not there and we're using videotape, we don't see any reason to exclude the public.
That's what I want to make sure. Since it didn't say it said during the testimony, it doesn't specify, so I want to make sure I understood.
Yes, yeah, more importantly, that it would also weaken the bill. The court would probably take a dim view of that.
Well, isn't this kind of like a dual thrust? One is rural and the other is urban. In other words, rural areas don't have to take the equipment and some of the urban areas will. This is the last for the same thing if you don't have the videotape.
Appreciate your comments, Senator Ray.
You don't understand it, huh?
Perhaps you could reiterate that one time your response from the chair. Or
with this other bill, what does it do? It allows you to videotape testimony, right? And this one allows you to clear the courtroom.
Yes.
Which certain areas won't have videotape machines.
Yes.
Urban, rural.
I wasn't aware you were referring to the previous bill. That may well be a problem. Mr. Crum, you prosecuted in a number of areas of the state, including on Alaska, I understand.
Well, it will be.
Rashid comment.
That could have that effect. I understand the court system is getting videos, though, around the state, because they're going to be allowing more and more videos in the courtroom. So I think probably after a while that won't be it. That's not the main thrust, though. I mean, what we were thinking about at the time about excluding versus video is that some victims, we might be able to videotape them very early in the proceedings if it's a young child without a jury, but other victims, the video wouldn't be as good for us, and we prefer to let them go in if they're up to it, but have the public excluded and let the jury actually see them in person.
Thank you, Mr. Trump.
One more prosecution, 2 years.
That's right, Senator.
I'm not opposed to it. Put those rascals in jail.
That's exactly what both of these bills will do.
If we're ready for, are you ready for action on this?
One second. yeah, perhaps we should, there may be other people here to testify on both the bills are similar. Mr. Crump, just a question. The question of the witness provision we were talking about just briefly before we came to the committee room with.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there it may not be appropriate to put these into the committee substitute that we've talked about, but there one question that has arisen that I had forgotten to mention earlier was that I would like to see some legislation, or at least the legislature think about giving the court the discretion to exclude the public during the testimony of minor children who are not the victim but who are witnesses to a sexual assault, but again, the discretionary language is part of the court. The court makes certain findings, and specifically what I was thinking at the moment was that there are many times that there are, it's not at all uncommon to have child witnesses with the child victims, and if we're trying to protect the child, each one of the child's emotional situation, then it seems to me we ought to consider some kind of bill that would protect the witness as much as the victim. And it's not, I don't think that the child's interest, excuse me, the witness interest is as strong as the victim interest, the harm that might be caused automatically, but it seems to me that giving the court some discretion would be important.
The committee might consider this point. Senator Bennett, please join us. Temporarily, we've.
It's been several years since I've been on this side of the building.
The House was kind enough to extend to us their facilities.
Well, you get reacquainted with it.
Same old place.
So we might wish to get reacquainted.
The suggestion has been made by Mr. Crum, and I think it's a good one, that we consider the possibility of incorporating into 547 a provision that would allow the witness, particularly a witness of tender years, and even more particularly when that witness is an essential element in the prosecution, to testify before the jury, absent the public. Does the committee have any feelings on this? Does the committee wish to deal with it in this bill, or as a separate matter, Senator Ray?
I like the concept and I understand it, but I don't know if I would feel a lot safer if you put it in maybe a different bill, separate bill.
We are ready to go with this bill, and that also mitigates against waiting.
What do you think?
That's, I'm where you are. I don't have to deal with this bill.
Very good.
They're different.
Same city, but different connotation.
I think different there, Dion.
Different connotation. I'd hate to drop this one because of it.
Fine. My feelings are much the same, and then we wouldn't hold it up unless it was strong feeling on the committee. Very good. Next, I'd like to call Paula Haley from where?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Paula Haley, and I work for Standing Together Against Rape, but I'm here today to represent the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And I'll make my remarks brief. I understand you've already heard testimony from someone else who's representing our network of 17 programs. We certainly approve the concept of protecting the victim, and I think we commented on the earlier bills before this new draft came out. I appreciate the additions that have been made, which would allow, under certain circumstances, an advocate or somebody who had developed a close relationship with the child to enter the courtroom and be considered within the definition of public. I also think the age change was a very commendable amendment. And I think the inclusion of press will also go over some of the possible constitutional challenges. The only concerns we have that we felt it's still necessary to express was that there is a possibility with the mandatory language that it would be considered less constitutional. And I think that listening especially to Mr. Crum's testimony, I understand the pragmatic problems given the fact that the defense attorneys may then just use this against using the presumption and call for psychiatric examination, which would be equally traumatic. And I think that is certainly up to you to balance those rights. And we just wanted to share our opinions and concerns with you today.
The committee will consider the witness question. We'll look at an appropriate vehicle, and there will be certainly additional bills coming from the House and additional bills in the Senate that would be deal with criminal law would be appropriate. Senator Ray?
Well, I don't know if this is pertinent to this particular bill, but I would like to make a statement that I am in support, and I am thinking about putting in a bill that would have the same restrictions or exclusion for all rape victims, because I think would certainly bring a lot more out in the open and give some confidence to some people who are emotional problems that this will not subject themselves. I know people that are so fearful of public inspection, you might say, that the last thing they want to do is go to court even on a traffic ticket. And if you get something as emotional as a rape charge or assault or something like that, where there's sexual connotations, they would rather suffer in silence and let the guy off the streets.
Mr. Chairman, I thank you very much for that, and we are certainly concerned, and you can imagine that we see many people through our crisis centers who are afraid to report for those very reasons. In that vein, there have been some states that have passed simple statutes that allow for the name and address of the victim to be stricken from the record, and that's one possibility as an initial starting point for adult victims that you might want to consider in the future.
I think we will want to take a look at this as well as the witness question. And I think all of us will be working together. Senator Parr is taking the lead on this, and we're all interested.
It would take about 10 words, and you could change this bill around for everybody. By just changing 10 words or 5 words even, not more than 10 words, you could accomplish that.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Senator. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill?
One question. I apologize for lateness, but line 15, is this what we really want to say? The order shall be granted if the court finds that a child is 16 years of age or younger. What I'm saying is that's up to the day before you turn 17. Is that what you mean?
Yes. Your interpretation is correct. That would.
Oh, I see.
quite often the statutes in the past, for instance.
Oh, this
at age 16, you can get a high school degree, you can get the driver's license.
Change around.
This is really sad.
Just put not less than, what are you complaining about the 16 years or 17?
You're saying is that what we want? Do we want 17? That's what we're saying.
What is the age that we want? When a kid is 16 or 16 and a half, or 16 and 343 days?
364, yes.
Yeah, that's what we
got. I'm not that hung up on it. Okay.
Mr. Stern has been touring Sitka and has missed all the major portions of this discussion, so it's probably unfair to ask him, but in the best tradition of the Senate, I will.
I think the reason they put the 16-year limit there was because the crimes against minors, it's I believe 16 or under, and as I say that, I'm not sure whether it's under 16. I mean, if you're exactly 16, we could check that easily enough. We're talking about one person.
You grab the statute, so you check that, please. Yeah. Statute, right. Yes. The committee will stand in momentary recess while the language in the existing statute is checked.
Is it a young girl 16 years old or less, if it's under 16 years, Jim?
Yes,
if it's under 16 years of age, is more likely to be emotional than one that's under 18. Get away.
Well, you may be.
The statutory language is existing statutory language is clear. To the extent that we conform with that, we will make the bill more immune from constitutional challenges. To the extent that we switch around, I what you say, of course, is entirely correct, Senator Ray, and there's no question about that. It's a matter of the law drawing limits at one point. Senator Bennett, your amendment would be on line 15, page 1, before the word 16s, add under before the Roman numeral.
Well, it shall be granted if the court finds that the child is less than 16 years of age at the time of the trial.
Is under 16
under
years
16
of age, and striking the words or younger.
Right.
Is there any objection to Senator Bennett's amendment? If there's no objections, Mr. Bruce?
I just wanted to point out to the committee that the previous bill that the committee just adopted has the same language, just to bring it to your attention.
So I would move we reconsider the bill and amend it to
we're considering this bill, so perhaps we ought to do this in an orderly fashion.
My apologies.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce. No, it's important to notify. If there's no objection, the amendment is adopted. Will be incorporated in the committee substitute for Senate Bill 547. Is there a motion to move Senate Bill 547 from committee?
So moved.
As amended.
Ask unanimous consent.
Is there any objection?
Pass.
Hearing no objection, the bill is passed from committee with a due pass recommendation. We'll now bring up reconsideration of Senate Bill 485. Senate Bill 547 is passed from committee on reconsideration. Senate Bill 485 is before the Judiciary Committee.
Line
16, page 1, Senator Ray, you have floor.
Move that the amended language is...
under is put before the Arabic numeral 16.
It was under 16 years of age and strike or younger.
Is there any objection to Senator Ray's amendment? There's no objections. The amendment to Senate Bill 45 is passed.
Will we now put it out as amended?
For the due pass recommendation.
Yes.
That motion has been made. Is there any objection to the motion to put Senate Bill 45 from committee? Hearing none, Senate Bill 45 is passed from committee with a due pass recommendation. Mr. Bruce, the committee is thankful for your diligence.
He's the guy that made the error in the first place.
Regardless of what Senator Ray may say.
He's the guy that made the error in the first place. Senator Bruce.
Next, I'd like to take up Senate Bill 535. And that relating to the criminal laws of Alaska. Mr. Stern, would you please join us? This is the quote cleanup bill, and could you tell us which portions of that bill are most important to you? There are
sure.
Certain sections, and Senator Parr has mentioned one, and that is the relating. into microwave transmission that the committee feels is not in sufficient form to wishes to pass on it.
Let me point out the ones that are not important. Section 5, in terms of things that are that raise some controversy, certainly Section 5 and Section 14, those are the two issues that Senator Parr raised. The rest, there are a number of things here that are, in terms of the scheme of things, are not very important, but there hasn't been any controversy raised about those provisions. Other than, Kevin, just do I...
The list, Mr. Chairman, isn't the list that I got in the memo form as to which ones were not very important.
Well, okay, in terms of what...
I don't know where that, and did say I was willing to go along to censure the ones that they considered important. I don't know what they...
Fine. I thought you were talking about controversial things too. Section 10, certainly not. Section 11, Section 12. I think 21. Did I miss anything, Mr. Bruce? I didn't write down the ones we had discussed.
I think those are the ones we discussed earlier.
Yeah.
What is the weight of what we're talking about now? Just because he doesn't like them again, or
no? In terms of
the rest of it's all no good or what?
No, those things that the department felt were were important to their prosecutorial efforts, and mm-hmm. some of the in fact the ones that have been deleted either have some difficulties with language or are so minor that the department is not concerned, but they would like to clean up. And the committee obviously is indicated that it doesn't like catch all bills first, and secondly there are some difficulties with some of the members have with provisions of the bill. The first one is the reckless injury, and I think we should deal with that one. So, Mr. Stern, do you want to?
Sure. Actually, sections 1 through 4 all deal with basically the same issue, and that is what mental state you have for the crime of assault, and by having intentionally, you allow the possibility for intoxication to be a defense to the crime. So this changes it to recklessly, and Senator Ray had on line 15, an amendment that I think the key move in passing. The
committee has adopted, adds the word other person in there.
Yes. I'll skip over section 5 since that's.
If I could go through this with the committee. Is there any objection to the language in sections 1 through 4? Again, basically in assault cases where intent is a requirement. If someone very, very badly injures somebody else, but did it recklessly, but not intentionally. Then they could not be charged. It's the argument between whether you're shooting into a crowded room with a shotgun, or whether you're aiming specifically at somebody is the difference. The results are exactly the same. And does any member of the committee have any difficulty with the language? I clearly understand what the prosecutors.
I don't have trouble with those, except I would like to point out one thing, at least is my understanding, again, as a layman, that intoxication is not usually considered a defense. And there was a case in Fairbanks within the last month in which a man got, I don't think he's been sentenced yet, but he's been convicted of, I remember, second-degree murder, driving a vehicle while drunk and running over some people.
Two
counts. So I'm not so sure that I buy the explanation. I don't really have any trouble with those sections, but I don't really buy the explanation. Just gives, in the present form, permits a defense of intoxication.
Well, that's only one aspect of it, and your point's well taken. But I think everybody would agree that the reckless aspect does allow a fairer prosecution than restricting it to only intentional injuries. That
as I said, it's this man who randomly killed these people on Fairbanks was the intention of torture.
The statute, the second degree murder statute, was structured a little bit differently than the assault provisions, and that's what made it possible.
I have no problem with that.
But on the other end, drunkenness is, or the diminished capacity because of the consumption of alcohol, more properly, is often raised as a defense in assault type cases. Is that correct?
Oh, certainly. That's the one problem we've had. One of the problems we've had with the code in terms of the way we define assault, that intoxication is raised as a defense. Whether the jury's going to buy it or not, that's another question.
That's where I think really the key issue is whether the judge really going to buy it. Yeah. Not the troubles that the Department of Law has. They are one half of this thing. We don't ever seem to have a public defender in here testifying, giving us the other side of the coin. You know,
we
it was an advocacy thing. We seem to have one half of the.
While we don't have the public defender, we do contact the Mr. Bruce
sitting here.
Yeah. They buy off on it?
I don't know if they buy off on it, Senator. I have contacted them repeatedly each time we've had this bill up, and they've never shown up.
I have a substantive change.
We have an adversarial system of justice in the United States, whether we like it or not. We have an adversarial system. Now, the Department of Law represents one side in this adversarial system. What the Department of Law thinks is best may not be the most balanced approach to the problem. That's the point I keep trying to make. No reflection on Mr. Stern.
Yes. I concur with you. The chairman feels strongly about reckless injuries because they're absolutely as fatal or as damaging as intentional injuries, and I think it's an artificial constraint that ill serves the public as a legal principle.
No problem with those sections.
But your point is well taken. Senator Ray, you have a substantive change.
Well, it's a consideration now. On section 3 there, a person commits a crime of assault in the third degree if he recklessly places another person in fear of imminent serious physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument. I can't reconcile it. You got it covered under 2. If he causes a physical injury, it's fine. I don't see under 2 there that places another person in fear, so it must be a lesser assault. If he just scares the hell out of somebody by shaking a baseball bat and say, I'm going to knock the hell out of you, and falls down dead drunk, and then the guy says, he threatened me, and the policeman says, what did he say to you? And the prosecutor said, well, this is what he said. Oh, we'll add that on in case we don't get him when he really hit that guy with a baseball bat down in the bar, and he come up and shook it in your face. If we don't get him down there in the bar, we'll get him on this other one.
Senator Wright, we didn't recommend any change to this statute. This exists today. This covers is ADWs, assaults with primarily with a firearm, where someone is placed in fear of imminent serious physical injury. If we don't have that crime as a felony, it is the lowest felony, it's a C felony, then it would be a misdemeanor to point a gun at someone and threaten them with death. Let me follow up from Mr. Stearns. There's two things. One, this is very old. This is very old law, and it goes
so
back to.
So is chopping off your head by means of an instrument. That was very old law. Cutting off your hand in case of theft. That was very old law.
Thank you for the less than Islamic law, Senator Ray. Secondly, this existing statute now, and it is to prevent someone from cocking a gun and pointing at somebody when the chances of that gun going off rise considerably. It's not a safe public practice.
I'm not in favor of gun control. I don't have a problem.
You would be if it was pointed at you. Is that right? Correct, Senator Bennett?
I am not.
I've been there before.
I am not in. You see, the whole thing that I don't agree with is the by means of a dangerous instrument. And in somewhere other in the criminal code, dangerous instrument can be explained as anything that can be used to cause physical injury. Or words to that effect. That's a general.
It's true.
Which means that a popcorn popper, the skillet off of the stove, you know, anything that you want to figure out, which are ordinary items of.
You.
Some guy gets a of people, these wipers, he picks up the skillet, and they'll knock you over under the head with it, he's going to get it for assault or with a dangerous instrument.
Covered under our domestic, that's covered under the domestic violence bill.
So. Oh, yeah, I know. What I'm getting at is that they...
If you want to put a specific exclusion in for frying pans...
I was thinking about that.
Well, the difficult... the law in this area, much of it is court, there is a body of law, and the court has interpreted it, and the saw...
They always want to spread. They always want to creeping... But pretty soon you won't be able to get in your car because it's a dangerous instrument.
Mm-hmm. It is perhaps the most dangerous instrument. Your car is far more dangerous than all the felons loose in the street in Alaska.
Not my car. I got chains on.
Senator, judging the condition of your car, possibly even more so.
No, my car is a good car. It's only got 12,000 miles.
Senator Ray, where is it right, your car right now?
Right there.
It's out of the repair shop.
It's never been in the repair shop. I got the fender in the back of the seat.
It'll only be a class 3, that's not
because it was a dangerous instrument if it was hanging out.
Oh, yeah.
No, but you know, it's too bad that with all of the intelligence that is incorporated in there, departments of law throughout the various, it seemed to me these days could do a lot better. Just instead of just a slap and a dash, and we'll get that just in case we need it sometime to get some guy.
Well,
you get a heck of a lot more respect, I'll tell you, than you're getting now.
Mr. Stern.
The point is that if this statute was taken out, if you had the assault, like Senator Rohde was saying, the assaults with firearms where someone's pointing a gun or a loaded gun even. This is the only provision that covers it, and it's a C felony. It's not the most serious felony. It certainly is a felony. And as to frying pans, we're going to have a pretty heavy burden there to show that the person...
Wait a minute. You already got it up here with intent to cause physical injury to another person. You already got that. That's enough. If he's pointed at it, it's physical intent that he's going
to
use it.
Well, you have to...
Down here, you say, if the person fears...
You have to cause injury.
Oh, by God, he was going to shoot me. And the guy was probably waving around like this. Have you ever had a gun pointed at you?
No, thank goodness.
Have you ever been in a place where anybody brandished a firearm with intent to use it?
No.
If you're standing 20 feet on either side, you swear it was pointed directly at you. And it isn't even at you. And you know how big it gets? That big, you could stick your head inside the barrel. So somebody that's not even in the line of fire,
Thank you for personal reminiscence, Senator Ray.
Have you ever had that happen? Well, I have. It wasn't very nice. That sucker looked that big, I'll tell you. But the guy was brandishing around, and he was drunk. And then he wasn't pointing at me.
We don't do such things at Spinard.
No, Spinard, you just shoot. No, but you understand what I'm getting at? You have it up here with intent to cause physical injury. Down here, it's... If you scare him.
Well, no.
There's a difference between scaring
which section are you talking about? Now, which line are you talking about, Andre?
Up here on under Section 2, the first, a second degree assault is with intent to cause physical injury to another person.
Okay.
But down here, it's if you cause him the fear of it.
Which line specifically?
Down here at 22. Places another person in fear of him.
Okay, that's the existing law.
Yeah, but that doesn't make it right just because it exists. Some guy put it in there some other time under the same circumstances.
I can assure you this is fairly old law, going back at least to 1200 AD earlier.
Just when the code was under the old law, if a person pointed a gun at a person or pointed a gun and shot at that person was treated as assault with a deadly weapon. And what the code has done is taken out the more serious conduct, which is causing the injury, which, as you point out, is line 14, and separated that and made it more serious than just simply pointing a gun at someone. So what the code did was take what used to be one crime, I believe punishable at 10-year maximum sentence, and broke it up into two forms of conduct to say, well, if he points a gun at someone, it's less serious than pointing a gun, pulling the trigger, and shooting him.
That's where all the fine lines come in. Because if you got a range of sentencing procedure, and for the same intent, for the same crime, a man is convicted of second degree assault, and the assault was pointing a gun at a person and scaring him, shooting at the person, or firing and injuring the person. And if you have a standard range of sentencing that ranges from 5 to 20 years, the sentencing judge, surely, if the man is convicted, can say, well, he just pointed the gun at him and scared him, so he should only get maybe 18 months.
Sure.
And then he fired at the guy and missed him. Okay, so he's a little stricter in a sentence.
Right.
And then the last, he hit him, so we give him a stricter sentence. Because you guys, you get it so screwed up,
but
finally you can't convict the guy half the time.
Senator Ray, that was not the intent of the recodification of the Criminal Act, and nobody knows better than Mr. Stern.
Well, nobody knows what the recodification of the Criminal Act was, except some guy wanted a job for a couple of years.
He came to me and asked me. Mr. Chairman,
President Company.
It's 10 years for the same conduct that a sentence in Anchorage could be 2. And what the code tried to do was limit the discretion of the prosecutor and the judges to say, well, the legislature is going to determine what's more serious and limit the judge's discretion there.
The polls all show there's relatively strong public feeling on this in support of defining the question of aiming a gun, shooting but missing, and shooting and hitting. The public doesn't want a lot of, a tremendous amount of judicial discretion. In fact, the public would limit judicial discretion perhaps far more than the legislature would. And we've limited it somewhat in the adoption of the criminal code.
The public is not satisfied with it, and they will not be satisfied with it until you take away the authority of the judge to eliminate sentencing altogether, no matter what the statute says. Okay? But every time that you ask the Department of Law to do that and to support it, they frantically move farther away so that you can't see where they are. We wouldn't want to do that. Oh, God, no, we don't want to do that.
We proposed a bill that's in Senator Parr is having hearings, was supposed to have hearings today on the parole bill, and under the bill that we have in the House, we're proposing to limit the judge's discretion more significantly for first offenses and eliminate the possibility of parole for all felonies.
I offered a mandatory sentencing bill for the use of a crime, or if you used a firearm in the commission of a crime, the prosecutor authority throughout the state would not use it.
We have today a statute that says there's a 6-year presumptive sentence if you have an A felony and you used a firearm.
Because you finally come around after 10 years.
we're
really right in there. Six years now, see.
Could we move on to section 4?
We moved on.
Senator, you have a question.
Yeah, I was. Have we done this thing where we kind of reward somebody for poor marksmanship?
No, that's the. I don't think that's what's happening. The addition is on line page 24, and just inserts the language causes physical injury to another person by means of a dangerous instrument. And this again is the reckless, the reckless aspect where intent is absent.
Yeah, under the current law, if you have an intoxicated person starts shooting his gun at a crowd of people and there's injury caused. The jury finds he didn't act intentionally. We've had cases like that. It's a misdemeanor today. This makes it a felony, C felony, nonetheless.
So. I realize I'm a lot tougher than the committee is on this point, but...
On what?
The reckless, or at least I appear to be.
To yourself, maybe. If you've been looking in the mirror, you've been talking to yourself. I think the majority of us are pretty strict on that.
I'm glad we're all together then.
If you hurt somebody, that's different. But just scaring them, that ain't nearly as bad.
And the difference is 10 years versus 5 maximum sentence. That's exactly what the code does.
There is a considerable difference.
All right. But you got the same thing in both deals. Intent and places of fear.
Yeah, but for the first one that you quoted, you have to have causing of injury. The second one all you have to do is have causing of
hearing. Can I make one word comment?
We move on to section 5, which we've deleted section 6.
Yeah,
tampering with a witness.
Yeah, that raises the penalty from an A misdemeanor to a C felony.
Is there any problem with that? Section 7.
This makes the defense of necessity an affirmative defense, and that covers the situation where a person engages in a crime to prevent a greater harm and changes the burden of proof. If the defendant raises their defense, he has the obligation of establishing it by a preponderance of the evidence.
What's the situation now, Mr. Chairman?
The presumption is the other way.
Mr. Chairman, let me ask a question. Again, I'm going to be way off base here today. I'm not sure where this necessity thing came in. But this, does necessity come in when you've violated the law and your definition or your justification is necessity to survive? That
would be one area.
What is your law against shooting moose except certain times of year? I don't know what they are. But someone is out in the woods and kills a moose out of season, and then is a charge for this, and his defense is that he or she was starved. He was out completely all by himself out in the boondocks, right? This was necessity to survive. Now, if I'm understanding correct, this puts the burden of proof overall on that person. Presumably he or she is out there in the woods.
No.
There ain't no witnesses around. And so how does that person meet that burden of proof?
It says,
if I'm understanding this thing correctly.
Senator Parr, on line 14, it says that unless legislative intent to exclude the justification of necessity does not otherwise plainly appear. In fish and game matters, there is specific language to the contrary that would avoid that, and as there are in several areas, and quite frankly, I can't give you a compendium of all the areas.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I just happened to be looking at the fish and game regulations. I picked it up in an office or something, and there is a specific provision there that allows a person to raise that defense. It wouldn't be covered by this provision.
So it would be
also allows them to break into a cabin.
It's breaking in the cabin. There's something already in the criminal code that significantly restricts that ability. As the Senator Parr's thinking about shooting a moose because you're starving, that's dealt with separately.
Breaking into a cabin, if you're in dire circumstance, you can break in.
That's exactly what the statute says.
I wrote the law.
Yes, that's exactly what it says.
Mr. Chairman, I understand it. This necessity thing is in the law to make sense when you have unusual cases. And they said if there's no specific law on the subject, we use common law,
right?
That's existing statute.
Yes.
But now what we do now is shift the burden of proof to the accused, as I understood Mr. Stern to say. What is the rationale for shifting the burden of proof to the accused? Because after all, we do have a my understanding that the state has the obligation of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that someone is guilty to the jury or one's peers or their judge. You know, why do we shift this burden of proof?
Yeah, if I might, the reason why it would be appropriate in this type of case would be that the particular facts that could establish the defense would be particularly known to the defendant. It's unlikely that the state in this kind of situation you described would have at its disposal the ability to marshal facts to dispute that kind of defense, which is so limited really to what's in the person's mind at the time and the circumstances he faces. And it's been felt that when you're dealing with this defense, it's fair, I guess, to say that it could be raised, but the defendant has the burden of proof on it by 50%. We still would have to establish the elements of the crime, but the defense could be raised. And as to what common law did, it's some people said that the defense of necessity, it's been argued to me at least that the defense of necessity was a affirmative defense in common law.
That wasn't where we
certainly.
The statute, when we did the code a couple of years ago, Mr. Chairman, that wasn't in there, then the people who drafted it didn't seem to see need to put it in. Part of the law is coming along, and I don't know, as I would see it, try to keep the balance somewhat. You know, that's, again, my concern about the proper balance in these things. I don't know if it's justified tipping or not. That's why I want to find out what the rationale is.
I think it's a question of who really has the evidence. I think the balance now is not fairly distributed in that the prosecutor has almost no knowledge of it in certain until the case is made. And it's appropriate that it be raised as an affirmative defense in my opinion. Senator Ray?
I don't know what all the arguments about it. Maybe I don't even understand it. But if I, as Charlie brings out the idea with a moose,
cabin.
Or a cabin, either one. Okay. I break into the cabin and shoot the moose.
Okay, in the cabin, okay.
Okay, I got two deals. Okay.
You'll do domestic violence as well.
There's been two crimes committed. Now, if I want to clear myself of those two crimes, I have to show justification where it was a necessity for preservation of my life. First, the prosecutor has to make up the determination whether a crime has been committed, and he has to prove that it has been a crime committed. But if I accede to that, and then I have to show cause, that's a check and balance. Otherwise, they say, hey, there wasn't any crime committed. I don't know who killed the moose, and I don't know who broke into the cabin. Then the prosecutor has to show it. But if I want to show justification that I have done these things and I admit whatever the legal word is, that I have committed a crime, but it was justifiable. Then I say, yeah, I did this, and I did this, but. So you don't check it down. So I don't see any problem.
Well, I do, Mr. Senator Ray, Mr. Chairman.
Where's the word?
Okay, suppose you break into this cabin. We'll take that as the easier one. And being a good Alaskan, before you leave, you chop some more wood so to fill in the wood, replace the wood you use, right? And so the owner comes there next spring and finds a cabin broken into, and so he goes to the troopers, and they know some wood's been cut, and so they take the fingerprints off of the axe, and then they identify you, and so they've got a case against you. You, however, are all by yourself out there. How do you prove to a preponderance of the evidence that this was necessary for your survival? That's the question that arises. Because under the affirmative defense, you have the burden of proof, not the prosecution.
Well, that's a fair example.
How do you prove this? I mean, I don't think of the example.
It isn't a poor example because there are certain contingencies. If I broke into the cabin under existing law, within 10 days I have to, in writing, notify somebody, I forget who it is, whether it's the owner and the police.
Either or,
that I have done this thing. In that respect, so if I haven't done it, if I haven't done the notification, I have per se committed a crime and have not admitted to it. In fact, I have attempted to cover it up because I never told anybody. I just went on about my business. Presuming that then you got the alibi, I didn't know who the cabin belonged to. But you know who the police are, and you can go to the police and say, hey, I broke in the cabin because it was 40 below and I had to get in out of the weather. If you break the law that you and you know it's or you have reason to believe it's breaking the law but it's justified, you almost for your own protection should go to the authorities and tell them I've done this thing and I did it because of this reason, and that way you have a basis of defense. But if you just neglect to do that then you go ahead and commit the act and just let it go quietly until somebody uncovers or finds it, then you, in fact, are guilty of a crime, that's all.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Parker.
I understand what Senator Ray is saying, but all he's really saying is that instead of the police having to take your fingerprints off of the axe, they know because you phoned them up and said, look, I had to break into this cabin. That doesn't answer my question, which is, how do you prove it was necessity? You're out there by yourself, but you have the burden of proof that this wasn't necessary for your survival. not the prosecution. You have a burden of proof if this goes through. How do you do that? That's my question.
Mr. Stern?
Well, whatever means you can.
I mean, how would these issues come about? One would be a plane crash. I could see that situation being plane is crashed and there's a cab in there. I think that's going to be fairly easy to establish. A hiker out in the woods and there's a snowstorm. I think the fact that there was a snowstorm would be easy to establish. I think these are going to be relatively, in cases where it's true necessity, it's going to be within the ability of the defendant to establish it. And Senator Ray is exactly right when he quotes from the statute, I'm breaking into a cabin, because in that case, the legislature tried to deal with the problem specifically and require a notice to the police or to the owner. And this doesn't change that. This says if you've already dealt with it, this isn't going to change it. Same thing with the killing the moose, because an efficient...
Wait a minute. This provides something in law, Charlie, that provides an affirmative defense in a case of necessity, which isn't otherwise in the law.
Right. Right.
No, sir. No,
yeah,
sir.
To hell it
well,
doesn't.
Well, wait a minute. Now, this says it is an affirmative defense.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but that when you... With, I don't know what you call it, it isn't an affirmative defense.
It's a regular defense.
A regular defense, okay. With a regular defense, you do not bear the burden of proof. With an affirmative defense, you do bear the burden of proof to the defendant. Now, if I'm correct, incorrect, the two lawyers can tell me. So what you're doing is adding to the burden of proof on the side of the defense when you do this.
But you got your choice. You don't have to cop out and let them go prove that you broke into the damn thing. When you cop out, you're trying to justify your act. You're trying to justify the act that would otherwise be considered a crime, and you're trying to moderate the circumstances to show that they were a necessity. And you, in fact, are copping out and saying, I did it, but I was forced to do it.
You're saying don't raise the issue don't raise a necessity issue.
You don't have to. The only time that you raise the affirmative defense is when you're copping out, trying to prove that you acted in good conscience and it's a matter of defense to something that would otherwise be considered a crime.
We're talking about the exception to the rule here with the cabinets, that really we're talking most, 80-90% of your cases are going to be assault and cases that involve confrontations between two people.
Well, with those actually, Senator Rohde, we have a specific provisions of self-defense, and there are the... We haven't put in anything to change that. There, it's a burden of proof is on the prosecution to establish.
These are single circumstances that could be considered a crime if you can't prove that you were acting in necessity.
What in terms of between two individuals would be included in this crime?
It's mainly property crimes. It's it was raised, I think, in a case where a person had to take someone to a hospital, supposedly, and broke into someone's car and drove away. And the question was it a theft? And it was up to the court talked about what the defense of necessity involved. And just the question is, well, who is in a position to best establish that the reason the person took the car was to take someone to the hospital? The person that did it by showing the medical records, that type of thing. And we have to establish the crime in the first place. And then, like Senator Ray says, after we've established the crime, if the defendant wants to raise his defense, he can by preponderance of the evidence.
A lot of times this is used by the prosecution or by the prosecuting attorney as a pre-examination, right?
Well, you mean in terms of screening cases?
Yeah.
Sure.
So that, in other words, it's an instrument, it's a self-protecting instrument in case something falls back on the prosecutor, but he didn't prosecute a case where he should have. Well, the guy told me, and he,
We'll have to adjourn the committee meeting now. We have promised the Resources Committee that we would return the committee room to them. I would ask all members to continue reading the quote cleanup bill, and we'll again have Mr. Stern before us. Appreciate
could
your...
Could I make one comment here? There's one part in here that you better, at least to my satisfaction, on this use of force in resisting or interfering with arrest. It's pretty broadly written, and I would suggest that you guys make a little attempt to define that a little bit, because you're not doing too much for me. Maybe the rest of the committee.
You're saying it's too broad that encourages people to resist, or that it doesn't protect the people enough in resisting?
It covers too many things.
it covers too many things. In other words, it gives almost carte blanche to a police officer, right, wrong, bad, indifferent.
That's exactly what it's intended to do, Senator Ray.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it should.
Well, I'm with you. That's what it's intended to do. I'm not so sure it should.
It's intended to do that, but I'm not so sure it should.
It's a policy decision for you to decide.
You could lighten it up a little bit. I think you could make it acceptable and it would do the things you want. But I think it's really strong now. You?
I think a good compromise would be just to put in the drunk in public as a misdemeanor.
I appreciate your suggestion, Senator Bennett.
I was arrested for and charged.
I understand the reason you're concerned now.
No, when I was in the Navy, I was charged by the Navy, and the charge was resisting arrest. The guy had a hold of my arm, and I said, "Let loose of my arm," and I pull my arm away. That's a count, resisting arrest.
Yeah, but we prevented that in the code because we say that in order to have a resisting arrest charge, you have to have physical force against the officer. Merely pulling your arm away from the officer would not be sufficient under the code to have resisting arrest charged. It's got to be physical force against the officer. So what we've tried to deal with that by defining the crime tougher to make it more difficult to prosecute your kind of case. That would not be resisting arrest in Alaska.
He got me on three counts.
Case law, Supreme Court Justice Black, the enforcement of the Uniform Court of Military Justice, that was not justice, it was a means of maintaining discipline amongst the ranks.
Yes. Of course, that's an officer talking to an ex-enlisted man.
Senate Judiciary Committee is adjourned.
Do you understand what he said?
I never talked
yes.
to
that. I don't mind giving the police plenty.
You're awful soft.
I don't.
I'm going to talk to troopers about your badge.
You never intended this. The thing is, you've got all these skills.
Kevin, stop telling the public.